Good morning. No need for applause. I haven't done anything yet. Before we get started, are there any questions or comments about anything, about what we discussed last week?
Why is he a patriot? He did so many bad things. Why is he a patriot?
That's an excellent question, and that's the question we started with. Why did God choose him to be a patriarch? That's an excellent question, and I'm looking for us to answer that. And maybe next week, as a conclusion, we'll talk about that in general. What redeeming qualities does he have to counterbalance the negative qualities that we've already talked about? Of course, the bottom line answer may be that we were talking this morning, that God doesn't owe us an explanation. God makes God's choices and doesn't always tell us why. And doesn't need to tell us why. God doesn't owe us an explanation. It's always dangerous when we ask why God did something. Because the answer is we have absolutely no idea.
I think it may be dangerous, but it's always been true.
I'm sorry?
It may be dangerous, but it's always been true.
What?
People ask about why God did things.
It's a natural question. The problem comes up is when we think we know the answer. The question is a good one.
Yeah.
But thinking we know the answer is when we get into trouble. I was talking this morning. We were talking that we sometimes fall into that fallacy with our prayers. We think sometimes that our prayers can control God. If we pray for something and we don't get it, well, that means God is mad at us. Well, God has a plan, and we don't know what it is, but our prayers don't control God. We just ask God for things. There's a tendency on Yom Kippur, the Jewish Day of Atonement that comes in the fall, that says if we sincerely repent, God will forgive us. Personally, I think that's wrong. We don't know what God will do. The best phrasing is in our liturgy where it says repentance, prayer, and charity can temper God's severe decree. Doesn't necessarily reverse it. In the book of Jonah, if you remember that story, the Ninevites get their theology right. Jonah announces in 40 days Nineveh will be overthrown. And the king declares a fast, even the animals have to fast, and says, we will fast and we will repent, and who knows what God will do. All we can do is our best. How God responds is beyond our control, in my view. But this is all a very personal, a personal position that each one takes. Anything else?
One thought maybe is we can look at Jacob and say, well, if he can do it, I can do it. You don't have to be perfect.
Absolutely. I think that is one of the main messages of the stories of all the people in the Jewish Bible. They're continually messing up. And the stories of the Israelites after the Exodus, my Rabbi Gibson calls it the Book of Kvetch. The people are always kvetching about things. Oh, we don't have enough food. We don't have enough water. We want meat. We don't like this manna stuff you're giving us, and we don't come off very well. But yet we have this connection. David committed murder, but he was able to maintain his connection with God. Maybe that's one of the lessons we can get, and maybe that's why he is a patriarch, because he still maintains his connection with God, as we'll see this morning. All right, anything else? All right, so where we left off last week, Jacob has 12 children, 11 sons and one daughter, from four different women. There are two full wives and two fuzzy wives. We're not sure what their status is. The Hebrew uses the same term that's used for wife, But it could also mean concubine. It could mean just a woman. But the two women that he married formally are Leah and Rachel, and he's got Bilhah and Zilpah, and we've got this whole conglomerate. When we left last week, the last thing we talked about was that Jacob was doing this. Jacob had made an arrangement with Laban. Jacob was going to work for Laban in exchange for all the multicolored sheep and goats. The solid-colored sheep and goats would be Laban's. The multicolored would be Jacob's. And Jacob found this strange method to make sure that the fox created the type of the colored offspring that he wanted by putting tree branches in front of the watering troughs, and tree branches with the bark peeled off. And we didn't get an explanation of that, but we're about to see that now. We're going to begin with chapter 31. And this is Now talking about Jacob. Now Jacob heard the things that Laban's sons were saying. Jacob has taken all that was our father's, and from that which was our father's, Jacob has built up all this wealth. Jacob also saw that Laban's manner toward him was not as it had been in the past. Then God said to Jacob, "Return to the land of your fathers where you were born, and I will be with you." Now, if we think back a couple of weeks, who was supposed to bring Jacob back from Haran?
His mother was going to bring him back.
Rebecca was going to. She said, go away, and I'll call you back when your brother's fury has subsided." Because after all, Esau threatened to kill Jacob, and that was the impetus for this whole journey. But here it's God telling Jacob to go home. And that will become important in a little bit. Jacob had Rachel and Leah call to the field where his flock was and said to them, "I see that your father's manner toward me is not as it has been in the past, but the God of my father has been with me." And here we see evidence again, as we saw in the story of Jacob's ladder, that Jacob understands that his success is due to God, not to his own merits or his own strength. "As you know, I have served your father with all my might, but your father has cheated me, changing my wages time and again." Now, we hadn't heard this before, but it's something that we could believe is true, knowing how Laban works. "God, however, would not let him do me harm. If he said the speckled shall be your wages, then all the flock would drop speckled young. And if he said the streaked shall be your wages, then all the flocks would drop streaked young. God has taken away your father's livestock and given it to me." He attributes the success to God, but he understands that he has benefited from it. "Once at the mating time of the flocks, I had a dream in which I saw that the he-goats mating with the flock were streaked, speckled, and mottled. And in the dream, an angel of God said to me, 'Jacob.' 'Here,' I answered. And he said, 'Note well that all the he-goats which are mating with the flock are streaked, speckled, and mottled, for I have noted that all that Laban has been doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now arise and leave this land and return to your native land.'" So now we understand that this business with the poplar shoots was a message from God. God told him, "This is what you need to do," and he did it. Now you could ask, why did God bother to go through all this this rigmarole, this somewhat magical process of the shoots? It seems to me that in many cases, God wants people to take the first step. God will put out will provide a sign or an impetus, but then waits for people to respond. At the burning bush, God does not speak to Moses until Moses has already turned aside to look at the bush. God wants people to take the first step. So doing what he saw in the dream was a sign of faith for Jacob. Okay, would somebody else like to read? Chapter 4, verse 14. Please. So we don't hear much about Jacob and Rachel and Leah having much of a voice in what's happened to them. They seem to have been objects of everybody else's machinations. But here we see them step forward, and notice that Jacob calls both of them out to the field. Even though he loves Rachel more, he understands that both Leah and Rachel are his wives. They're Laban's daughters, and he needs to consult with both of them. And they are not in doubt at all. Just as their aunt Rebecca was before, when she was asked, "Will you go with this man?" she immediately said, "I will go." So they say, "It's time to leave." They are fully supportive of Jacob. Please continue. Padan Aram. Okay, now this people nowadays think this is an anachronism. Archaeologists think that camels weren't domesticated till many centuries after this, and it's something of a problem for people who take this literally. But as we talked about in the first session, we're not taking this literally. We're taking this as a story that we're being told for a purpose. So the fact that maybe a later author introduced camels because that's what people were expecting back in a later time shouldn't really disturb us too much. So Jacob is leaving now, and if we remember where our map, if you can see this, Haran is way up here. And he's heading back down to the family, which is in Beersheba and Haran. So the family is down here, Beersheba and Hebron. Haran is way up here. So he's going to make this journey.
In miles, what would you say it would be?
I believe it's around 200 miles. Okay. So it's a significant trip. Well, it's not a matter of how fast camels can go. Camels can run pretty fast. Camels will beat horses in certain distance races. But the limiting factor is how fast a sheep and goats can travel, because they need to graze along the way. So I don't know the answer to that, but I suspect it's not very many miles a day.
Mm-hmm. And for the safety of getting the family out of the way as quickly as possible.
Yes, and it shows something else, because people, even when they had camels and donkeys, they didn't ride on them. They were to carry the goods. So the fact that he's putting his children and wives on the so that they can ride rather than walk shows a consideration that we wouldn't have expected necessarily from him.
It's interesting, though, that he didn't approach Laban. He just took off.
And that's going to we're going to see what happens here in just a minute, because Laban is going to find out about it, and we'll have a very significant interchange that's about to come up. So Jacob leaves, and he has not told Laban what's going on. And well, we'll find out for a while. Ma'am, would you like to read? Well, verse 19.
Rachel stole the idols.
Yeah. Now, why would she do that? And I can think of two reasons, one of which is positive for her and one of which is negative. Why would she take the idols?
She believed in them.
She wanted them because she was leaving her household and they were a comfort to her. She wanted to worship them, or she wanted their protection. That's the negative one.
Perhaps she regarded that as her inheritance.
Okay. But that means also that she had respect for them. She considered that they were valuable in some way. If you were an apologist for Rachel, why would you think she took them? I'm sorry? Well, that would be a negative one because in the view of the Bible, of course, these idols are nothing but wood and stone. They're not can't offer any protection. The positive response that some of the commentators give is that she wanted her father not to worship them. She figured if she stole them, then Laban would perhaps see that they're worthless, stop worshiping the idols, and maybe become a better person. Please.
And Jacob deceived Laban and Aramim in that he did not tell him that he intended to flee. So he fled with all that he had. Starting out, he crossed the Euphrates and set his face toward the hill country of Gilead.
Okay, Gilead is... Gilead would be down in this area, which is on its way back to Canaan. I'm sorry?
What's going on here? We have Jacob the patriarch with household gods.
Yes, but he doesn't know they have him.
No, that's not the point. The point is he had
him. Yeah, well...
Why?
Well, I'm not sure I understand your question because he doesn't know they're there and we just talked... Rachel did this on her own. Laban's. They were Laban's household gods. Okay, sorry.
Do you think that there is a chance that Rachel stole the gods to keep her father from praying to them to send the gods or whoever after them and harm them? And if he didn't have them, he wouldn't be able to pray to them?
So she thought they were powerful, but she was stealing them so that he couldn't connect with them. Yes, that's a possibility. But that also implies that she thinks that those gods have power.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's still problematic for one of the matriarchs. I mean, we talk generally about the patriarchs, but don't forget we're also talking about the matriarchs. Okay, please continue.
So he took his kinfolk with him and pursued him for 7 days until he caught up with him in the hill country of Gilead. But God came to Laban, the Aramean, in a dream by night and said to him, "Take heed that you say not a word to Jacob, either good or bad."
Okay, now I think I've talked before that the combination of two opposites is called a merism, and it can just mean everything. So God appears to Laban and tells him, don't do anything to Jacob. Says God is saying that he's under my protection. But of course this means what? That Laban also has a connection with Jacob's God.
Yeah.
And Laban listens to Jacob's God. When he gets a message, he also pays attention to it. Okay, somebody else like to read?
Where are we, 22?
25.
Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country, and Laban with his kinsfolk camped in the hill country of Gilead. Laban said to Jacob, "What have you done? You have deceived me and carried away my daughters like captives of the sword. Why did you flee secretly and deceive me and not tell me? I would have sent you away with mirth and songs, with tambourine and lyre."
So, Laban presents himself as the injured party here. Oh, you did this bad thing. I would have made you a big going away party had you told me. If only you had told me you wanted to go, I would have done all this thing. I would have been happy to send you off. I don't know how many of us believe that that's really the case, but Laban is really laying it on thick here. Please.
And why did you not permit me to kiss my sons and my daughters farewell? What you have done is foolish. It is in my power to do you harm. But the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, take heed that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad. Even though you had to go because you longed greatly for your father's house, why did you steal my gods? Jacob answered Laban, because I was afraid, for I thought you would take your daughters from me by force. But anyone with whom you find your gods shall not live. In the presence of your kinfolk, point out what I have that is yours and take it. Now Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen.
Okay, so Jacob is building up a head of steam. Laban has accused him of stealing. Notice he refers to his sons and daughters, although he has no direct sons in this case, but he is considering all of these to be his children. In Hebrew, the word for brother and the word for sons and daughters are kind of flexible, and they can mean not the specific relationship of a son and daughter that we think about, but it could also mean this connection here, the direct descent. So he's saying they're my daughters. These are all my sons. But he has done something else that's going to come back. It's going to change his life. He says, anyone with whom you find your God shall not remain alive. You know what happens to Rachel? I don't know if this is something, you know, as part of our weekly ritual in the Jewish worship practices, we read a section of this part of the Bible every Saturday. So we hear this story over and over again once a year. At least. So we know what's coming up. And I don't want to treat this as a mystery story. Rachel is going to die in childbirth. She's going to die giving birth to her second son. And the author, I think, is trying to make a direct link to that tragedy with Jacob's harsh words. Jacob speaks without thinking, which is not like him. He's usually the one who's very careful and plotting about what he does. But he's building up a head of steam, and he's really going to let loose his frustrations. He's been working for Laban for 20 years now with all these things going on. Okay, continue.
Laban fell all about in the tent, but did not find him. And she said to her father, let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the way of women is upon me. So he searched, but did not find the household gods.
Now, the Torah, the Bible, one of its main themes is the tension between idolatry and monotheism, even though at this point we think it's not, it may not be as pure a monotheism as was developed later. You need to understand the disrespect that this text is showing to these idols, who Laban regards as powerful beings. She puts them under the seat cushion and sits on them and tells her father that she has her period. Now, the context of this, even though, well, it may have been true at that time, but it didn't become law till later. During the time of her, that a woman is having her period, she is ritually impure. The Hebrew word is tameh. It's often translated as unclean, but that's a bad translation. There is no good translation to it. It means that you're not eligible to come to participate in worship and sacrifices. That's also true of other discharges. A man and woman who have sexual relations are tameh until evening, until they take a bath. They have to wash themselves and take a bath. So she is saying that she is ritually impure, and she's sticking these idols in the source of her impurity, which is hardly a respectful thing for her to do if she thought these idols were able to offer some sort of protection. But this is a very deliberate thrust against against idolatry. So he searched but could not find the household gods. Would somebody else like to pick up the reading?
Then Jacob became angry and upbraided Laban. Jacob said to Laban, "What is my offense? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? Although you have helped about through all my goods, what have you found of all your household goods? Set it here before my kinsfolk and your kinsfolk, so that they may decide between us two. These 20 years I've been with you, your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried, and I have not eaten the rams of your flocks. That which was torn, wild beast, I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it myself. Of my hand you required it, whether stolen by day or stolen by night."
Okay, need a little bit of context for this here. Now, a shepherd's job had very, very specific rules. A shepherd was responsible for protecting the flock from anything, from wild animals, from the flock, from individual animals straying away. But it was recognized that a shepherd couldn't be awake 24 hours. So if an animal was torn by one of the flock was torn by a wild animal during the daytime, that was the shepherd's responsibility, and he would have to take that out of his own paycheck. But if it happened at night, then it's not his responsibility, and all he had to do was to bring the carcass to the owner of the flock and say, "This happened at night," and there would be no penalty for the shepherd, because obviously he would be allowed to sleep. What Jacob is saying is here, no, you didn't even give that to me. Whether the animal was killed by day or by night, you took it out of my paycheck. You cheated me. You did not treat me the way shepherds are supposed to be treated.
It was like this with me. By day, the heat consumed me, and the cold by night, and my sleep fled from my eyes. These 20 years I've been in your house. I served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flock, and you've changed my wages 10 times. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been on my side, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God saw my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you by last night."
Okay. So Jacob lets loose his 20 years of frustration, all the things that he says Laban has done to him. Now, some of these things we hadn't heard about before, but again, we can believe that they happened. I'm sorry?
This is a real rant.
Yes. He's, and to some degree, Jacob is putting his life on the line because Laban is there with all his family. And they all bear him a grudge because they think he's stealing their inheritance. The only thing Jacob has on his side is God telling Laban not to do anything to him. And he does get the sense that Laban is respecting that. So Laban is presented with this position, and he has a choice to make. So what does he do?
Well, question: he doesn't know about the dream.
Who
he doesn't know about Laban's dream.
Well, he does, because Jacob, Laban just said to him, "But the God of your father." Back in verse 29, I have it in my power to do you harm, but the God of your father said to me last night, beware of attempting anything with Jacob, good or bad. So Laban has told Jacob about that. Okay, would you like to continue? Yes.
Then Laban answered and said to Jacob, the daughters are my daughters, the children are my children, the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine. But what can I do today about these daughters of mine or about their children whom they have borne? Come now, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me. So Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. And Jacob said to his kinsfolk, gather stones, and they took stones and made a heap, and they ate there. There by the heap. Laban called it
Yegar Sahaduta.
But Jacob called it Galeed. Laban said, this heap is a witness between you and me today. Therefore, he called it Galeed. And the pillar, Mizpah. For he said, the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent, one from the other. If you ill treat my daughters, or if you take wives in addition to my daughters, though no one else is with us, remember that God is witness between you and me.
Okay, so Laban essentially gives up. He makes a big show, say that everything you see is mine. But what can I do? I'm such a kind-hearted father. I can't do anything. So essentially, he makes a big show of things, but he gives up. Now, these names that we read are puns. Gal is a mound. Aid is a witness. So it's a mound of witness. Mizpah is a hill, but it also... is related to may the Lord watch between you and me. Watch is yizpeh, which is like mizpah. So God, Laban gives up, but he leaves Jacob with this imprecation against treating treating Jacob's wives, his daughters, improperly, which is maybe makes us think a little bit better of Laban. He is concerned. He is showing concern for his daughter's welfare.
When you consider all the things that Laban did as good, and God had prohibited him from doing either good or bad, so how does Laban has been gracious and he's been welcoming to Jacob, but God forbid him from doing either good or bad.
I'm not sure I understand your question. Try again.
Well, he's doing good.
Okay. Well, yes, although maybe not. Maybe he's unhappy with how much good he is doing, because he didn't, according to Jacob's side of the story, Laban did everything he could to make sure Jacob didn't do as well as he was doing. He tried, according to Jacob, Laban tried to cheat him at the time and again by changing his wages. So Laban wasn't quite being beneficent about all of this. It was just he was just being being overtaken by events that were being controlled by God. Had it been left to Laban's decision, all the stuff would still be his.
It seems like the scales are weighted against Laban. God is on Jacob's side. The dream.
Mm-hmm.
Letting Jacob get away with all this
thing? It certainly does, because Jacob is under God's protection. That was the promise that God made in the dream as he was heading outbound. That God said, I will be with you and I will protect you and I'll bring you back. So yes, that is very definitely a message here that despite all the problematic things that Jacob has done, Jacob and God still have this connection, this covenant, and God is going to honor God's obligations under the agreement, one of which is physical protection.
Kind of an out-of-the-way question here. This one phrase sounds like it's a prayer I've heard before. It says, the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent from one another. I've heard that in prayers when groups meet, and they say, the Lord be with you and me when we are absent from one another, and then there's some other words. Does that really become a prayer?
Well, it's not in the Jewish liturgy. I can't speak, of course, for the Christian liturgy. It might well be. I'm not familiar with it as part of our liturgy. Yes?
Well, I was going to talk about the same thing, because we say the Lord watch between you and me as a blessing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and yes, it's Laban is giving up in this situation, but he's saying, don't try to take advantage of me again. God, watch over us, and God wouldn't let me do anything to you. Well, don't you try to do anything to me. I'm sorry, I can't answer the question. Or at least I can tell you that it's not part of the Jewish liturgy. And Laban said to Jacob, here is this mound and here the pillar which I have set up between you and me. This mound shall be witness and this pillar shall be witness that I am not to cross to you past this mound and that you are not to cross to me past this mound and this pillar with hostile intent. May the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, their ancestral deities. Remember who Nahor is. Nahor is is Laban's grandfather, the son of Abraham's brother. Judge between us. And Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. Jacob then offered up a sacrifice on the height and invited his kinsmen to partake of the meal. After the meal, they spent the night on the height. Partaking of a meal was a sign of completing a pact, completing a covenant. Now, this is the second time that this appellation for God has been used, the fear of his father Isaac. We're not sure exactly what the Hebrew means. Fachad does mean fear, but it's in this context, it seems rather strange. So we're not sure exactly what that means or what that was intended to mean. Okay, so since this isn't a mystery story, I'll tell you this is the last we see of Laban. Laban is gone. We won't hear from him again. As you're probably aware, Passover is coming up. One of the things we read in the Passover Haggadah, in part of the retelling of the story, it says, my father was a fugitive Aramean. And nobody's quite sure what that means, but they link it to this story that Jacob was coming from Aram. Haran was also called Padan Aram. And he was fleeing from Laban, who wanted to destroy him. Okay, anything up till now? All right, so Jacob is free of Laban. So now thinking back into our overall picture, what's the next problem Jacob has to face?
Esau.
We talked before that Rebekah was going to call him back when his brother's fury has subsided, but she never called him back. God called him back. So the question is, what's going on in Esau's mind after 20 years? Is Esau still mad? Jacob would probably assume so, or else his mother would have called him back. So going home is not all that comforting to Jacob. He has this this next hurdle to deal with. Yes?
Question, kind of theological. I get a sense of a God who is, I guess in the language of today, he's not nonpartisan. He decides. And you know, the Christian notion of God is different, I think, that God is on everybody's side. I think there are some people that feel that way. But here we have a God who definitely picks his sides.
Absolutely. Because the rest of the world, outside of this one particular family, worship idols. And that's terrible. That's terrible. This is not a neutral God. This God is waging a war against idolatry. And that war becomes concrete, of course, in the story of the Exodus with the 10 plagues. That's a very, very direct confrontation between the God of the Israelites and the gods of Egypt. So this is not...
The one God chooses becomes the center of the God's universe.
They do after they accept the commission. Jacob accepted God's covenant. God said, Jacob said, you promised, made all these promises to me, well, I'll respond. If you do these things for me, then I will be loyal to you. So Jacob responds. And again, thinking about the Passover story, Moses does the same thing. Moses responds. It isn't until they do that that God can, that the covenant can be made. The first thing God said to Abraham was, get out, leave Haran. And it wasn't until after he did that that God was able to say, I make this covenant with you. Presumably, if Abraham had ignored the call and stayed where he was, there wouldn't have been a covenant. Okay, well, I'll read this. Early in the morning, Laban kissed his sons and daughters and bade them goodbye. Then Laban left on his journey homeward. Jacob went on his way, and angels of God encountered him. When he saw them, God said, this is God's camp, so he named that place Machanaim. Machaneh is a camp, so it's an encampment. Okay. Now, again, I think I mentioned this before, the chapter divisions are basically Christian in origin. The Jewish preference, the portion that we read on each Sabbath, ends at this point rather than at what you have as chapter 32, because this appears to us to belong to the previous story rather than the beginning of the next one. Okay. Would somebody else like to read?
Jacob sent messengers ahead of him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. He instructed them, this is what you are to say to my master Esau. Your servant Jacob says, I have been staying with Laban and have remained there until now. I have cattle, donkeys, sheep, and goats, men servants and maidservants. Now I am sending the message to my lord that I may find favor in your eyes.
Okay, so what is Jacob's first approach to dealing with the problem of his brother?
Give him a bunch of stuff.
I'm sorry? Well, he's not giving the stuff now. He's just telling him about the stuff. So what's his first approach?
Sending people ahead to let him know that
he's... Right, but he is. But what's he trying... What's, I'm sorry? Well, not yet. That'll be the third one. Now he's
trying...
Subservient. Yes, it says your servant is coming back. So there's this. I'm sorry.
He's trying to show that he's
humble. Yes, but he's all.
He's saying, "I have all this stuff. I'm not coming to take anything from you."
Right. Okay. That's a peaceful way of doing it.
He's doing reconnaissance. He's trying to find test the water to see what kind of response he's going to get if he does this.
Yes, but his basic approach is to try to impress Esau. Your servant has stayed away all this time, but look at all this stuff I have. I'm a rich and powerful guy now. I'm not the penniless person who fled from the camp when you threatened him. I'm a person to be reckoned with now. So what's Esau's response?
In great fear and distress, Jacob divided the people who were with him into two groups, and the flocks and herds and camels as well. He thought, if Esau comes and attacks one group, the group that is left may escape.
Okay, so Jacob, Esau is coming with 400 men. Obviously, he doesn't need 400 men to just say hello. So the implication that Jacob takes from this is that Esau is coming to attack. The number 400 is problematic. That was a huge force for those times, but it's a big number. 10 times 40. Two of the favorite numbers in the Bible. So Jacob begins to take defensive measures. And we'll see how that turns out in a little while.
Then Jacob prayed, "O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, the Lord has said to me, go back to your country and your relatives, and I will make you prosper. I am more unworthy of all the kindness and faithfulness you have shown your servant. I had only my staff when I crossed this Jordan, but now I have become two groups. Save me, I pray, from the hand of my brother Esau, for I am afraid he will come and attack me, and also the mothers with their children. But you have said, I will surely make you prosper and make your descendants like the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted."
Okay. All right. So what is Jacob doing now?
He's calling on his covenant with God.
He is calling in his chips. He's saying, God, you made these promises to me. I'm calling you to account. This is the first prayer that we have in the Bible. As far where we hear the direct words, we were told earlier that Isaac prayed to God on behalf of Rebekah so that she would have a child, but we don't know what that prayer was. Here, Jacob is speaking to God under the terms of the covenant, and that hasn't happened before. Even with Abraham, we don't have this kind of discussion with God. So Jacob is calling upon the promises that God made when he was leaving Haran, and he wants God to fulfill them now. Please continue.
He spent the night there, and from what he had him, he selected a gift for his brother Esau: 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 female camels with their young, 40 cows, 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys, and 10 male donkeys. He put them in the care of his servants, each herd by itself, but said to his servants, "Go ahead of me and keep some space between the herds." He instructed the one in the cleave, "When my brother Esau meets you and asks, 'To whom do you belong, and where are you going, and who owns all these animals in front of you?' then you are to say, 'They belong to your servant Jacob. They are a gift sent to my lord Esau, and he is coming behind.'" He also instructed the second and the third. third, and all the others who followed the herds. You are to say the same thing to Esau when you meet him, and be sure to say, your servant Jacob is coming behind us.
Okay, so if Jacob's first approach was to impress Esau with how well he's done, what's his second approach? What's he trying to do? I'm sorry?
I don't want to use the word bribe.
Why not? That's what it is. He's trying to bribe him. He's trying to ransom himself from Esau's wrath. Yes?
So doesn't the separation of the group into two camps to avoid one being destroyed and also the offering of the bribe, doesn't that show a lack of faith that God had promised that he would be safe, that God was with him? Descendants would be multiple, and now he's taking defensive measures that Laban could actually do some harm to him if God would not protect him.
I see what you're saying, and that's always a struggle, isn't it? How much do we leave to God and how much do we do for ourselves? Even though he trusts in God, does that mean he should just sit down on the ground and bare his neck to Esau when Esau comes? Or should he take some action on his own and ask for God to make his actions successful?
Here's a
thought. I'm sorry?
It says, before that, it says he spent the night there. So he, he prayed. He was in seclusion. Perhaps he woke up inspired.
Mm-hmm. Okay, perhaps this is another dream that he had that God told him what to do. You could read that into it. But it's just because you have faith in God doesn't necessarily mean that you should not take any action. What do we say? God helps, heaven helps those who help themselves. The story about the man who was trapped on his roof in a flood. I sent three people to save you. Why didn't you do something yourself? You can't rely just on God. So I'm not sure that I would take this as a lack of faith. I would take it as a trying to work to set up conditions where God can work easily and do what God promised. You could look at it the other way, though. I wouldn't say no. Okay, so finish up the paragraph, if you would.
For he thought, I will pacify him with these gifts I am sending on ahead. Later, when I see him, perhaps he will receive me. So Jacob's gifts went on ahead of him, but he himself spent the night in the camp.
Okay, so now we're going to have a pivotal experience in Jacob's life. Again, I'm not sure from your point of view how much of this you know, but Jacob is let's read it and then we'll talk about it. Would somebody else like to read the next portion?
The same night, he got up and took his two wives, his two maids, and his 11 children across the border of Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream, and likewise everything that he had. Jacob was left alone, and the man wrestled with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he struck him on the hip socket, and Jacob's hip was cut out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, let me go, for the day is breaking. But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. So he said to him, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. Then the man said, you shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with humans and have prevailed. Then Jacob asked him, please tell me your name. But he said, why is it that you ask my name? And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the place Peniel. Saying, for I have seen God face to face, and yet my life is preserved. The sun rose upon him as he passed Peniel, limping because of his hair. Therefore, to this day, the Israelites do not eat the thigh muscle that is on the hip socket, because he struck Jacob on the hip socket at the thigh muscle.
Okay, this is a very mysterious passage here. Because it begins by saying Jacob was left alone, but all of a sudden there's a man who's wrestling him until the break of dawn. So if he's alone, who is this man? Who is this man? I'm sorry? God? Okay. Not directly, perhaps, but God would, an angel of God, perhaps. Okay? And that is general. That seems to way, seems to be the way that Jacob interprets it, because he later says, "I have seen a divine being face to face." So he interprets it that way. What else could it be? What else could be going on here?
Could it be Esau?
Not many people come up with that. Could it be Esau? Sneaking ahead of to try to do his own reconnaissance, and he comes upon Jacob and attacks him, and they fight to a standstill. And that will come up. So we'll see next week, because when Jacob and Esau finally meet, Jacob says to him, "Seeing your face is like seeing the face of God." Which could be a sly way for him to, for Jacob to be telling Esau, "I know it was you."
Could be a dream.
Could be a dream. In which case, who would he be wrestling with?
You're wrestling a dream.
He's wrestling himself.
Yeah, same be it.
It could be that his own internal struggles. I mean, this is a very traumatic time for him. Yeah. Are such that he's wrestling with himself. He's struggling. You could say that his two natures are struggling against each other: the trickster against the one who has the connection with God. And the dream is so intense that he actually injures himself. The new name that he gets. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes.
It says he goes his 11 children. So Dinah doesn't count.
As right.
A child.
Yes. Well, actually, your translation was 11 was children, but the Hebrew word, let me check this just to make sure. 23. Yeladav. It's actually in the masculine. But in the so it would be the literal translation would be his 11 sons. But the problem comes up is because I think I mentioned before the plural, the masculine plural in the Hebrew is also used for a combination of male and female. So it could go either way. Yisrael.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask about that. We go back to the story of Abraham, Abram becoming Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
And here we have Jacob becoming Israel. Is there a connection between the two?
Oh, yeah. Well, yes, and as I said before,
is now somebody different?
The importance of a name is very deep. So by giving him a new name, it seems to indicate that he's becoming a different person. He was Jacob, the heel grabber. And that's what Jacob means, if you remember. Yaakov means heel. Now he's becoming Yisrael, which means the one who struggles with God. El is God. Sar is Yisrael. Let me see if I can read it to you. See if you can. 29. Ki Sarita. So Sar from Sarita, Yisrael. The one who struggles with God. And that, of course, is the name by which Jews call ourselves. The country, our country is named Israel, but even deeper than that, we're called over and over again, B'nai Yisrael, the children of Israel, the Israelites. So Jacob gets the name by which our people is known today. This problematic person, but now he's been changed by this experience, physically as well as mentally. He was presumably a strong person. Remember, he rolled that big rock off the mouth of the well, and he took care of the flocks for 20 years. And now he's physically injured. He walks with a limp. Yeah. And this business about not eating that part of the meat, well, that's true today. If a kosher butcher... It's very hard to get the hind quarter of a cow in a kosher butcher shop, because the butcher would have to remove the sciatic nerve, which is a rather difficult process. So the hindquarter, you can get it, but it's very expensive. So this is one of the rules of kashrut, which we follow, those who keep the rules of kashrut, follow to today. And it comes from this story. Oop. Anything else before we go? We'll return to this story again, I think, before when we come back next week, because it's a pivotal one. And keep in mind the possibilities of who this wrestling opponent was. But whoever it was, it had a profound effect on Jacob and on the way he sees himself and his mission in life. I'm sorry?
He gets humility.
Okay.
He gets humility.
Yes, he becomes physically maimed, and we'll see, in fact, how he finally... His first approach was to impress his brother. His second approach was to bribe him. His third approach will be humility.
Well, doesn't the name Israel tell us who he was wrestling with?
That's certainly the way he interpreted it. And that's the way whoever he was wrestling with wanted him to interpret it. Okay. Whether it really was or not. The general thought is that, yes, it was an angel. But because of all these strange things, why should you ask my name? But those go as well for the other possibilities too. Let me go, for dawn is breaking. If it's Esau, he wouldn't want Jacob to see who it was. If it's a river demon, which other people also think it might have been, then they were active at night, but not during the day. The fact that we don't know for sure is one of the things that gives this story so much tang. Well, thank you. See you next week, I think.